Welcome to Manager Tools. This is a special podcast for our Manager Tools and Career Tools community, where I get to interview Dr. Jeffrey Sanchez Burks of the Ross Business School at the University of Michigan. It's brought to you in conjunction with our advertising partners at Midroll. Here we go. My interview today is with Dr. Jeffrey Sanchez Burks. He's a professor of management and organizations at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. Let's get to it. You're going to enjoy this greatly. Let me start with Dr. Sanchez Burks. Another area where we haven't talked a lot at Manager Tools where I think you could help our audience is in negotiation. So talk a little bit about innovation and negotiation. Most of what I read about negotiation is about obviously understanding what's important to you, being willing to understand that the other side has other perspectives. You mentioned different perspectives before. I mean, most managers, I would say, would naturally go, how important can innovation be in negotiation? But you think otherwise.
Absolutely. In fact, when it's a straight transaction, there's no creative deal no creation in the deal is needed. But precisely when you think there's an impasse or where there's difficulty, this is where you need to come up with creative solutions. What I have found is that people never think of creativity and negotiations at the same time. But in a sense, what you're trying to do is come up with a creative solution. Well, how to do this? One very simple technique that I've had a lot of success with executives, MBA students, is to have them draw a piece of paper, and on the first column, write down the standard things you would expect. What are all the issues you care about? Rank order them. Why do you care about them? If you have to make concessions, which ones are the right ones to make? But then on the other side of the piece of paper, do that same task, but thinking about the other person. And first, people think, this is impossible. How can I do this? And then we talk about forecasting. Well, in business, we make forecasts all the time. Right. Why don't we make a forecast of the other side, trying as best as we can to imagine their position, write down not just what we think they care about, but why they care about it. Once you have those two lists, both on the left and the right-hand side of the piece of paper, this will now enable you to start to anticipate potential trade-offs. They're going to fight back on salary, and I care about salary, but I also care about the position or the manager I want to get if I'm negotiating in a job offer.
Right.
So what if I try to make that concession? So you can start to identify potential concessions, strategic concessions in advance. This has been a very profound experience for people to both take the time to forecast the other side's perspective and then take that into the conversation where they don't assume their forecasts are correct,
right,
but they try to test their assumptions.
Yeah. So here's an example that I remember from a couple of years ago, dealing with a counterparty in a negotiation. And it was very clear after a couple of hours that they were not going to budge on any of their criteria. And when I asked them about that, they said, no, I mean, our goal is to win. Surely someone who comes into a negotiation thinking that way, and I assume there are a lot of people who do, if their goal is to win, I'm assuming that reduces their willingness to be creative. And I worry that a lot of managers, a lot of executives, they see it as a competition, and they put competition, and they say creativity and competition, or innovation and competition. What they think about is winning versus innovation.
That's completely fair. There is an illusion that negotiations are purely competitive. The more holistic, accurate way of looking at it is that there's both a competitive and a cooperative and sometimes a compatible component to it. When people say we want to win, where I usually push back is I really sort of test their belief that this is a one-shot transaction. They'll never see this person. Their reputation of this, how they behaved, will never get out. And they don't care about the relationship. Those happen. Maybe you're buying some trinket in a foreign land. But in normal business operations, you're looking for long-term deals. There's partners. There's times when somebody needs to make their number this quarter and have more flexibility the next quarter. But the creativity component comes in precisely when you reach such an impasse. So for example, one of the big challenges for organizations is cross-selling. When you come to an impasse on one issue, and the person will not make a concession, this is when you need to be creative. Now, creativity in this case may be, what are the other products and services your organization needs that my organization provides? Maybe we're not representative of that part of the organization, but this is where you're cross-selling. So creativity here means what additional items can be put onto the table so that we can actually give you what you need on this number and you win, but the organization and me win because we're able to think about what are the other issues that can be put onto the table. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It's interesting. Several times you've hinted at something that we think is hugely important and not talked about. And I'm guessing that it's a part of the kind of stuff you teach students at Ross, which is relationships, the importance that, I mean, you describe transactions as a node in time. And we at Manager Tools and our audience generally see relationships as being the thread that connects us. And we're going to, as the example you use, we're going to see these people again and again and again and again. Talk about relationships a little bit, how important you see them being in terms of professional career.
Sure. And I can talk about relationships using the parlance of economists in terms of transaction costs.
Okay.
When people are behaving ridiculous, we often sort of just think, well, there's, maybe something wrong with this person. An alternative way of thinking about it is this is inefficient, not only for me, but for that other person. It's clearly taking time, emotional energy, stress, and so forth. If we go back to this perspective taking advice, really what you're trying to do here is, why would this person behave in a ridiculous fashion? Why would they incur these transaction costs? Do they feel I am going to cheat them? Do they feel that they have too little power? Do they feel that they're under extreme pressure? Basically, what I'm trying to do is generate hypotheses about why they would engage in ridiculous behaviors so that I might be able to come up with ways to address it rather than just assume they don't care about the relationship. So if we think about bad behavior, misbehavior, or inefficient relations, it's a transaction cost. If we get good at the relationships, we reduce the transaction cost. So that is sort of a core value to focusing on the relationships.
I want to go back to creativity for just a second. I've never thought of myself as a creative person. I've been told many times, that's your fault. You can be creative. There are things you can do. Let's put ourselves in the mind of the situation of a manager or a director, essentially a junior executive at a large organization. She has 10 people to manage. She obviously has a boss and she has metrics that she needs to meet and so on. What's your sense of the average manager's creativity? What are they missing? What are they not doing that's readily available that doesn't require them to think of themselves as a creative genius? I know this is a hackneyed phrase, but sort of low-hanging fruit that we could share with the audience that will help them say, oh, that's something I could do, and I guess I never thought of that as being creative, but if doing that would make me creative, that'd be good.
So one thing to remove and one thing to add. The thing to remove is this misconception that creativity is a trait. You have it or you don't have it.
Right.
The thing to add is could be packaged in one word, bricolage. It's a fancy French word, but it was basically put into use by an anthropologist, a French anthropologist, Levi Strauss, to capture what is at the essence of innovation, creativity, as it's been defined from the ancient Romans to modern times, which is putting together things that already exist in new combinations. Now, that's the definition of bricolage. If we just simply think of creativity as bricolage, innovation as bricolage, now we actually have a framework for moving forward. So what I want to do is when I'm faced an impasse or I'm trying to come up with a creative solution, is think about how I might be able to recombine two things that already exist into a new combination. I'll give you a couple of examples of this. Okay. One was done at, the challenge was, how do you understand ways to improve underprivileged kids' absenteeism? How do you get those kids to school more often? And you can come up with a bunch of reasons why that might be the case. But in this case, the organization tried to understand not just this was an appliance company, Whirlpool, that was selling products, but trying to understand the needs of people very broadly. What's their perspective? Well, what's interesting about this story is they discovered through this perspective taking that a lot of these kids didn't come to school because they had dirty clothes. And all of us could remember bullies and mean kids. And if you put those two insights together, it comes up with a very easy solution is why don't we try putting some washing machines in the school and as a test, see if this will help get the kids come. So basically the teacher is more than happy to wash some of these clothes for the kids. Absenteeism, the success rate was like 90%. What's interesting here is the novel solution came by recombining two obvious things, but it required some perspective taking. So
wow.
This was This was one where really combining things that already exist.
Yeah. I mean, to me, that feels creative. I get the point about perspective taking. And so what you're saying is the kids came to school because now they could wash their clothes and they weren't going to get bullied because their clothes weren't dirty.
Exactly. And even another interesting example, this is sort of an old classic one. There was a woman, Betty Graham Smith, in the 1950s. She was a secretary by day, which basically her job was typing. And at that time, all typists faced a big problem. When you make a professional typist, when you make an error, a typo, you had to start over because there's no way of correcting it. Right, she was a painter by night. She loved it. She was a commercial painter by night. One day she had this aha. What if I create a version of my paint, white, and it dries very quickly, and I could brush it on. She used these nail polish bottles and brushes, and I could essentially paint over the mistake and type over it. She invented liquid paper. What she did was recombine two things that already exist, her paints and this problem of typos. What's interesting is it took her so long. There was no new knowledge gained. Typos weren't a new thing. Right. Her expertise in painting wasn't a new thing. And here comes the key to bricolage. Part of the reason why bricolage is difficult is because we separate different parts of our experiences. For her, it took this thinking about work and her leisure life, essentially, at the same time. Now, I'm not advocating we want to always think about work while on vacation and so forth. But when there's innovation, we're trying to connect dots that other people hadn't thought of before.
I have to tell you something. I am guilty of that. When I'm working, I'm thinking about work. And, you know, I happen to play golf, but I'm not sure I've ever in my life taken a moment to say, how do I think about golf? What do I do at golf? What are my approaches to problems that I'm faced with frequently on the course? Honestly, I mean, I think I'm the classic example of what you're talking about, of somebody who separates, because this set of skills is different than that set of skills. But you're saying the underlying, the way our brain works, how we're wired and so on, the different wiring that might be in a leisure activity could, in fact, help us in another area. And I think I raise my hand and say I'm a classic example.
And I think the separation can be completely functional. But when you're trying to innovate, you're trying to sample as broadly as possible across your own personal experiences and the experiences of a team. I'll give you another example. I was working with a financial institution. They were interested in improving the experience of their customers opening a checking account, a financial account. And I had half of them come up with ideas. Half of them, I said, before we do this, why don't you think about your personal life, growing up, family, friends, children, vacations, whatever. Just sort of pause for a moment, maybe write down one memory. Now, while that's in the back of your mind, come up with some ideas. That group came up with more and more original ideas. One said, you know, I was on vacation with my family at Disneyland just last year. And what's interesting is while we're in the queue, they had a sort of TVs and information along the way so that when we got to the ride, we could get on there more quickly. What if at the bank, while people are in line, we could do the same? That idea already existed in their head, but it required managers, in this case me, just giving a little subtle prompt for them to think outside the organization before they try to tackle an organizational innovation problem. That leads to more successful bricolage.
Wow. Okay. So I'm gonna take you to the next level. So this group comes up with this idea that, hey, we want to put screens in the waiting area to help people with their experience and to increase our chances for being more successful. So this manager has an idea. We're going to condense all that down to the idea of a senior manager or a director. And now he has to go get budget, or she has to go get budget from her boss. And her boss is immediately dismissive. We hear this all the time. Mark, we can't do that because our boss said, the company said we can't. Can you talk a little bit about how to be creative, if you will? This sounds terrible to say it this way, against the power structure. How can a manager, or even a frontline manager, be more effective thinking about innovation and creativity when they're trying to get their ideas heard, when they're trying to get past that initial no? And that initial no, we talk about it in Manager Tools, is just so easy to give. There's no risk for me as someone's boss to say, no, we're not going to do it. Because I'm part of my job, I think there are many managers who believe, you've probably experienced this, their thought is not necessarily to seek success. And they certainly want success, but the first thing they want to do is avoid failure. And that has always felt not creative, not innovative. If I'm trying to avoid failure, what I know about creativity and innovation is, if you're creative, if you're innovative, you're going to get some stuff that's not always fantastic. You're going to take some risks, and there are a lot of managers who aren't as comfortable with risk as the organization might want them to be. So talk about a manager trying to get an idea approved, trying to persuade somebody, trying to get their point of view across to someone with perhaps as much or more power than them. How can those managers be creative or innovative?
It's a great question. In my executive MBA classes, I have people who are helicopter pilot, trainers, physicians, people running larger organizations. Wow. Everyone is facing the same sort of challenge. When I say, you know, we're going to innovate, we're going to create, they think, well, but in my organization, it's really important to be successful and failure is not accepted.
Yes. Yeah.
And so it's a great question. You could think at a very simple way, this innovation creativity process is really in two different chunks. The first one is bricolage, ideating, creating new ideas.
Right.
The next is really about curating. And curation is a word used purposefully because a curator isn't about the curation process isn't about generating ideas. It's about selecting and testing ideas. The key here, and I love to help people fly under the radar, is be able to test ideas so quickly and with so little resources, they don't need to get approval. And everyone's eyes light up with, you know, how do we get you to be able to do things without approvals? Like, yes. And it's essentially rapid prototyping. When people come up with an idea, what we're finding, I'm working on this in my current research as well, is we go from creating into a sales mode. I want to build the best prototype, the business case, and show everybody this is the greatest idea. And then when it doesn't get approved, we get deflated. If we actually switch from sales mode to back to this mode of, you know, what we need to do is gather evidence. We need to test experiments. So I want a quick, dirty prototype that will actually give me insights about its problems. I can do this in more quick, in shorter cycles so that my idea will become better and better. In fact, what we're finding is that when you're trying to get feedback on your idea, if you come across very positive, very, you know, committed to this idea, others are less likely to give you feedback. You've seen it. Somebody shows you a really well-polished prototype and you're like, they invested a lot in that. I don't want to deflate them. But if they came to me with, you know, some sticks, a tape, a cardboard box, or just some horrible sketches, I would say, wow, you really need me, and try to give you as much feedback as possible. So what I work with managers, have your people not present you finished products, but try to go with very quick, dirty prototypes so that they can learn the insight, learn about the opportunities to improve the idea, and keep and repeat this. We're going to be able to, A, better understand which ideas aren't worthy of pursuing so that no one wastes their time or their career on that, but also getting ideas better faster.
So this is fascinating. You can't see me, but I've been sitting here with a grin on my face for the last minute as you've talked. First of all, for me anyway, maybe everybody else knows this, but I didn't know it. What you just said, here's one of the things I just heard you say. First thing. One, someone with your background, someone who has knowledge of innovation, creativity, and also research and so on, you're not at all against the idea of a quick and dirty solution that's prototyping. And yeah, we know it's got some problems, but as long as we get slightly better or better results than what we were doing before, if we can fly below the radar and we can do it quick and dirty, and to me, quick and dirty has always been a little bit of a negative, you're saying that's absolutely a better way to go in many cases.
The task is getting good data. The task is not having a polished product. So the quick and dirty refers to how polished the idea is and how polished the presentation is. We want good data. And in order to get good data, it all goes back to empathy and perspective taking. We need to understand what will get other people engaged in our idea. Engaged in our idea such that they will give us honest feedback about it.
If I go to them, literally, I come up with an idea, and I know other people have done this, come up with an idea, and you're absolutely right. The first thing we think of is, okay, I have to pitch this. And then I think about the people in the audience, and I think about going to them and so on. You're essentially saying that there's a risk that the harder I work to make it seem good, to make it seem right, to make it a finished product, the more likely they are to push back. And if I come to them and say, hey, I've got some early results here, I want to share them with you, but I'm not 100% on this yet, they're much more open to the idea of giving me useful input rather than giving me a yes or no. Our natural tendency then internally in corporations, and there's an awful lot of, it sounds terrible to say it, but posturing in large organizations where you feel like you have to look good, it has to be right, and the PowerPoint has to be perfect, and there has to be animation and everything else. You're suggesting that before you go to the sales phase, just stay in the weeds a while longer and create data, and don't worry that it's perfect, because you don't need it to be perfect. In fact, if you present it as perfect, that's actually going to work against you in some cases.
Yes, and there's two additional things. I mean, you had asked originally about how do you sell the ideas, because ultimately you will have to do that. By actually involving people and involving more people in this prototyping phase, you essentially are gaining their support, because the final product, they will have given feedback on. And so you're increasing the odds that by the time you go for the sell, it's not a brand new concept. There are many people right now who have been able to contribute and be engaged and give their feedback. So it's not like you want to think of this as a secret agenda that you're selling it. But what we find is the byproduct of involving people in that that process gets them more engaged. When you're presenting ideas in this very early phase of prototyping, or not presenting, but so much trying to get that feedback, what essentially we're finding in our research is you want to come across as ambivalent. And I know it's very easy to think of that term as indifferent, and it's not. In the more technical sense, ambivalence, feeling both positive and negative, when somebody presents an idea and they come across as, you know, I see a lot of hope and promise in this idea. That's the positive part. But I know it's not perfect, and I'm concerned with some of these issues. We naturally feel that this person is more thoughtful. We can trust them more. They're seeing both sides of the coin. And so the research and the recommendations we're giving is, rather than go into a positive sales pitchy mode, maintain that natural ambivalence all creators have, where you see pros and cons to it, and you don't overplay either. The idea isn't to try to make yourself ambivalent, but not to lose that more balanced perspective right you have with an earlier prototype.
At the University of Michigan Ross School of Business, you can earn a top 10 ranked MBA for executives 1 weekend a month over 21 months. The program is offered both in Ann Arbor and in Los Angeles. The Michigan Ross Executive MBA has a leadership development focus, including personalized assessments, executive coaching, coursework, and experiential learning. You'll participate in an executive multidisciplinary action project, a project immersion course in which you solve an actual complex business challenge for a sponsoring organization. The Michigan Ross EMBA curriculum is rigorous, is designed to account for an executive's extensive experience. Courses are taught by Michigan Ross's most senior and renowned faculty to help you achieve a greater professional success. And you'll gain tools to immediately increase your effectiveness as a leader. Become part of the Michigan Ross network of over 45,000 alumni worldwide. The University of Michigan Ross MBA for Executives is a unique opportunity to reach your highest potential. Learn more about the MBA for Executives at michiganross.umich.edu. One of our 1,000 podcasts is called Prewire. It's something that virtually every executive I've ever known in a large organization knows about, but many junior managers don't. And the idea is, when you have an idea, when you want to pitch something, if you're going to go make a presentation to, say, your boss and his or her peers, before you ever go into that room and present for 10 or 15 minutes, you've got to meet with each of those people individually, and you need to be willing to modify your idea, your proposal, to essentially satisfy the various people who are stakeholders in the outcome, the people who are going to be voting on it, if you will, when you actually make the presentation. And we tell the story that so often a manager who's sitting in the side of the room when that presentation is occurring and the pre-wire has already been done, they're amazed at what a slam dunk the presentation is. And they think, well, this person, she's an outstanding presenter. And what they don't know is it's not the presentation, it's that work in advance. And what you're saying is that the mindset when we go into those individual meetings should be, I'm open to your ideas. I'm not trying to win you over to my point of view. I want to share my point of view. And I'm enough of a professional and smart enough to recognize I don't know everything. I'd really like to hear what you have to say. And you're saying that then gets them bought into the idea because they see themselves as helper rather than as a person who vetoes.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of good research. A lot of it's done here by my colleagues in my department here at Michigan that shows feedback seeking obviously is good in the sense that you get data, but people appreciate you more. People like others who are seeking feedback. So that's kind of what the core research is. But it can be tied again back to this perspective taking in the following way. When you're seeking feedback, you're essentially acknowledging you care and value about the other person's point of view. So it's not that you're engaging in perspective taking, but you're communicating, you're motivated to do just that.
Okay, I want to wrap us up. Your time is really valuable. A simple final question. As you think about the students you have the opportunity to teach at Ross School, and you think about creativity and innovation and your portfolio of the things you teach, when you look at all the managers you've worked with, what is the thing you see that would be easily done, or if there are a couple of things easily done, opportunities they have to get better? Maybe actually they're okay in it, but there's a huge opportunity for them to get better. What are the things that really would make a vast majority of managers much better in their day-to-day, workaday lives that they're probably not even aware of?
Have regular, authentic interviews with the people you work with. What I mean by that is conversations that don't have a typical business agenda, that are brief, and that come across as very sincere, where you're trying to understand the other person. It may be what is driving their awesome level of engagement, or what could get them more engaged, what they care about, what are their goals and aspirations. Have a conversation in which you can generally learn about other people. This will then, when things become very difficult or very stressed, or you're at quarter end, sales targets are coming on, better enable you to be able to adapt, because you, it's not perspective taking is on the fly, just in time perspective taking. You have woven this through your managerial style of trying to understand where people are coming from. And the classic bias is for us to assume that what drives us drives others' behavior. It's a natural tendency, but having these authentic conversations at a regular tempo allow you to be enlightened, if you will, that what may drive specific people may be different. And I don't mean this for just the problem people. The people who are highly engaged are at risk to go just to be so-so engaged and further down. So it's an approach useful for across the board. When you're negotiating, and I don't mean just a business transaction, but essentially trying to say who's going to do what on this project or similar things within an organization, the process is no different. Trying to just be very mindful about what are my assumptions about the other side. Little reminder, like I mentioned earlier, drawing a line down the piece of paper, these tiny nudges you can give yourself to try to take the other person's perspective is going to pay off big dividends, because there are so many situations where our assumptions about what's driving other people are wrong. And they may not, or our assumptions of what driving people are right, but the other side doesn't know it, and we haven't figured out what factors are inhibiting them.
You know, it's fascinating you're saying this. Our audience will laugh, because one of the things Manager Tools is famous for is one-on-ones, that we recommend every manager create a trusting relationship with their directs. And coming from an engineer like me, I learned this the hard way. You can be smarter, you can work harder, you can have better ideas, but if you don't relate to other people, to your point of view, if you can't adjust your own perspective by taking their perspective at certain times, and you can't do that unless you know them well, you're never going to be as successful as you could be, because organizations are a lot of people, not just a lot of individuals. And it's fascinating to hear that when I ask you for an overarching idea, you come right back to something that we teach in a very narrow way, which is one-on-ones.
Just to expand on it, just very, very briefly, you know, one-on-ones, so in addition to that, there's also something about your ability as a manager to be able to read the team, to read the group. And, you know, I've done work on this called emotional aperture, and there's like a 5-10 minute free online assessment you can take. But essentially what it does is gives you feedback about how well you're able to read the group. If you just make an announcement about a new strategic initiative, what proportion are having a positive or negative reaction? Is my blind spot to overestimate positivity or underestimate negativity or the reverse? So complementing one-on-ones with what we often overlook is emotional intelligence at the group level can also help. So just having people get data and feedback about their ability to read the group is another sort of way to propel them to engage in that more.
Professor Sanchez-Burks, I have to tell you, this has been a treat for me to not be the one who's doing most of the talking and to learn from somebody who's smarter than me about stuff that's important to me. I feel very fortunate, and I appreciate you taking your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, folks. I hope that was as much fun for you as it was for me. I learned something about myself. I hope you learned something about creativity, innovation, and of course, the kind of professionals they have at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. See you next week.